Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Managing Neurologic Manifestations of Tuberous Sclerosis Complex, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Ajay Gupta, MD, and David Neil Franz, MD. Dr. Gupta is an associate professor, Department of Neurology Medicine, Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine, staff physician, Epilepsy Center, Cleveland Clinic Foundation, Cleveland, Ohio. Dr. Gupta has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Lundbeck Research USA and Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation. He received grants for clinical research from TS Alliance. Dr. Gupta does not intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Gupta does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Franz is a professor of pediatrics and neurology, Ohio State University, Springboro, Ohio, director, Tuberculosis Clinic, Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center, Cincinnati, Ohio. Dr. Franz has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation. He served as a speaker or a member of a speaker's bureau for Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation and UCB Pharma. He received grants for clinical research from Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation. Dr. Franz does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Franz does not intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to discuss the management of patients with TSC, including neurologic manifestations, early diagnosis and treatment, management of epilepsy, and emerging data on the role of mammalian target of rapamycin inhibitors. This activity is supported by Novartis. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello. My name's David Neil Franz. I'm a professor of pediatrics and neurology at the University of Cincinnati College of Medicine and the director of the Tuberous Sclerosis Clinic at Cincinnati Children's Hospital Medical Center in Ohio. I'd like to welcome you to this Medscape Education CME certified activity titled Managing Neurological Manifestations of Tuberous Sclerosis Complex. The overall goal of this activity is to discuss the management of patients with Tuberous Sclerosis Complex, or TSC, focusing on neurologic manifestations. Specifically, we plan to talk about early diagnosis and treatment, management of epilepsy, and emerging data on the role of mTOR, or mammalian target of rapamycin inhibitors. I'm very pleased to be joined today by my colleague, Dr. Ajay Gupta, who's associate professor at the Cleveland Clinic Lerner College of Medicine, Case Western Reserve University, and director of the Multidisciplinary Tuberous Sclerosis Program at the Cleveland Clinic, also in Ohio. So, Ajay, let's start with the basics. Would you give us a brief overview on Tuberous Sclerosis Complex, or TSC?
Yes, certainly. Thanks for having me, Dave. As you know, Tuberous Sclerosis Complex is a disease which is genetically inherited in a dominant fashion, which means if you have a patient with tuberous sclerosis, he or she has 1 in 2 chances of passing it on to their offspring. The disease affects about 1 in 6 to 10,000 people. It was believed to be much rarer, but it has been found to be more common, and usually, many people have very mild symptoms and may remain asymptomatic for long duration of their life before they actually get diagnosed with this condition. Now, this condition affects multiple organs. The key organs that are affected in tuberous sclerosis complex are brain, eyes, skin, kidneys, and in females, it affects lungs as well. In very young children, infants, it can involve heart, and sometimes that could also produce symptoms. So it's a disease that involves many different organs. The key important thing is it involves these organs at different stages of life, and many times the involvement as well as the progression of the disease is not predictable.
Okay, so what's the incidence and the epidemiology of tuberous sclerosis?
Like I stated, the disease is estimated to be involving 1 out of 6 to 10,000 people, and it is an autosomal dominant disease, and it can be due to one of the two mutations. The two genes that cause this disease are TSC1, or tuberous sclerosis complex 1, which is also called as Hamartine, and TSC2, also called as tuberin. You cannot usually distinguish between one versus the other based on a clinical phenotype, and typically gene tests can be done to make or confirm the genetic diagnosis.
So that was my next question, is how do you typically diagnose a patient with tuberous sclerosis?
Like I said, you can have a mild phenotype that can present later in life, and often in these individuals, one has to sort of connect the dots between different symptoms and signs these patients have to think about that possibility. However, in children, some of the common things like seizures or infantile spasms, which are special type of seizures in infants, can prompt one to look for this diagnosis. And usually, if you do a good clinical examination followed by some targeted testing, one can think about this diagnosis if a patient fulfills a clinical criteria. So there is published criteria that one can follow to think about this diagnosis if the patient qualifies and has the clinical exam or testing that suggest this as a possibility.
I know in our clinic the issue often comes up about the genetic test, which certainly can be useful if you have an unclear case, but it is many times it's an expensive test, and sometimes there are issues with insurance reimbursement. So as a practical matter, most of the time I think we make a diagnosis on the clinical basis, as you mentioned, and I think the genetic test is not something that's essential for the diagnosis, that many times, you know, if you are aware of the manifestations, you make the diagnosis clinically. Would you agree with that?
I would think that genetic tests often do not change your plan of care for the patient. However, you know, once you have the diagnosis, it's something that one should offer and discuss with the family, and certainly one should consider every aspect of their care before deciding when to send the test and if to send the test. Certainly, every situation is different, and one should, you know, discuss it with the family and then take and make that opinion.
No, I think you're absolutely right. What are the neurologic manifestations of TSC?
The most common neurologic manifestation of TSC is really seizures. And the most typical or a classic patient is an infant, usually, you know, somewhere below the age of 9 months to 12 months, who develops what we call as a special type of seizures called infantile spasms or epileptic spasms. I think any patient who has infantile spasms, one should consider TSC as a possibility. That would be a classical way of presentation. However, seizures can begin later in childhood, sometimes even in young adulthood. Other common manifestations are developmental delay. Sometimes you can have a child with autistic features. Usually, delay and autism happen in the setting of a patient who already has seizures. Behavior and psychiatric issues are common. And in about 10% or 20% patient, over time, usually after the first decade, one can see a tumor type, a tumor which is called a subependymal giant cell astrocytoma, which is a benign tumor that appear, which may be asymptomatic or may cause some symptoms down the road. Those would be the common neurologic manifestations of tuberous sclerosis.
One thing that I find is that many people think that if you have tuberous sclerosis, it means that you have to be mentally retarded. In fact, for when I was in medical school, we were taught about Voigt's triad, which meant that if you had TS, you were mentally retarded, you had intractable seizures, and you had facial angiofibromas. Could you maybe speak to some of the range of intellectual ability in tuberous sclerosis?
Well, that's a great question. I think that stigma that this diagnosis had back then reflects our lack of ability to diagnose patients with mild phenotype. And I think what Voigt triad told us that when we did not have genetic tests or when we did not have sophisticated testing available, most people were diagnosed clinically because they had very obvious severe phenotype. I think it is very well known that up to 50% patients with tuberous sclerosis may have a very mild disease and they have normal cognition, they live normal life, they have jobs and they go to school and have good education. So I think that stigma is no longer true, and many, many patients with tuberous sclerosis have very, very accomplished lives. So therefore, the diagnosis is not a signal of any bad news. In fact, this is a very important education that we always do when we have a patient in a family with tuberous sclerosis, that not every patient with tuberous sclerosis is devastated or severely affected. And in fact, most patients, if managed very well, do very well.
No, I completely agree with that. I think that's one thing that a lot of people don't appreciate about TSC. But you'd mentioned subependymal giant cell astrocytomas, or some people call them subependymal giant cell tumors. Can you tell us a little bit about the incidence of these sorts of tumors and what they mean for a patient when they have one?
Sure. The frequency of subependymal giant cell astrocytoma probably falls somewhere in the range of 10 to 20%. And like I said, they could happen at any time, but they are most likely to be seen in the later part of the first decade or second or third decade. Usually they occur in the frontal lobes at the foramen of Monroe, which is the foramen that helps with the flow of cerebrospinal fluid between the lateral and the third ventricle. Because the foramen of Monroe is such a tiny foramen and the canal is so thin, if the tumor grows, it can obstruct it, causing hydrocephalus, which can cause raised intracranial pressure or headaches. In very severe cases, if the growth is rapid or the diagnosis is not made, it can cause some motor deficits, it can cause some cognitive deficits, it can cause some behavioral changes. And it remains unclear as to how this tumor grows, and I think it may be very variable from patient to patient, and I am not aware if there's any clear way of predicting the natural history of this disease in a given patient. So certainly one should use periodic clinical examination and also periodic scanning of the brain, usually by the MRI, to look at the size of the tumor and therefore determine when would be the appropriate time to begin the treatment. Would you agree with that assessment, Dave?
No, I would. I think people have tried to identify these tumors in various ways. I mean, by having a certain size or by having a certain, by taking up contrast, and really the only reliable way to diagnose a tumor like this, because people with tuberous sclerosis also have something called subependymal nodules, which can take up contrast and sometimes can be near the foramen of Monroe, is that a giant cell astrocytoma exhibits growth over time. And, you know, many times, as you point out, that until that reaches a size that it's going to cause hydrocephalus or increased intracranial pressure, there's no symptoms associated with that necessarily. Sometimes patients can have an increase in seizures or headaches or irritability. But, no, that's I think that we're really dependent on seeing that these lesions grow, you know, to indicate that they're going to cause a problem. These don't spontaneously regress like in neurofibromatosis. So once they start to grow, you have to expect that they're going to continue to grow. Mm-hmm. The standard treatment for SEGA has been surgery, although, as we're going to talk about later, that may be changed. I think there's evidence that that is no longer, you know, the only therapeutic option. And sometimes, of course, surgery can lead to complications, such as hydrocephalus or bleeding or different infection and different sort of problems. Actually, some papers quote a morbidity of 10 to 20%, or actually a mortality of 10%, which I think is a bit high in the modern era for this SEGA. So what's your feeling about the use of surgery for SEGAs? I mean, that has been the standard treatment.
Correct. So I think once one documents that SIGA is actively growing, or you have a patient who has a clinical symptom that are explainable by SIGA, I think the option of surgery versus taking this new medication, which is now FDA approved, is there. And certainly, I think each patient is unique, and depending on the patient profile, their age, the size of the SIGA, the symptoms it's causing, and the benefits and the risks of surgery versus medical option, one can discuss and choose the appropriate treatment. And I agree with you. Until now, we only had surgery as an option, but certainly FDA has now approved this new medication called everolimus in certain patients who are not candidates for surgery for SIGA. And certainly that gives another option for treatment in those patients who may not be good surgical candidates.
No. Well, Ajay, after all, you're an epileptologist, and of course 90% of patients or more with tuberous sclerosis have seizures. Can you tell us about the standard treatment approaches for controlling seizures in these patients, which are often refractory to medication?
Sure. As I said, a classical patient has infantile spasms. If infantile spasms are diagnosed, there are two FDA-approved monotherapies for this condition. The first one is called ACTH. It's an injectable, very highly potent steroid that's given every day for a course of 8 weeks to 12 weeks. As you know, steroids have their own side effects, and very careful monitoring and observation is necessary. The other FDA-approved monotherapy for infantile spasms is vigabatrin, which was approved in this country in late 2009. Again, it's a medication that has efficacy in this condition. It is given by mouth. It does not have a specific duration of treatment like ACTH has. However, it has a black box warning in the form of causing irreversible visual field constriction in certain patients who are on this drug. And certainly, given that infants are not able to report their symptoms, one may not be able to diagnose these visual deficits until late. So that's very important, and therefore one has to follow what we call as a REMS program, R-E-M-S program, or risk assessment program, so that one can determine benefit and risk for initiation and ongoing therapy with this drug. And there is some evidence, at least in the literature, to suggest that when infantile spasms are due to tuberous sclerosis, perhaps vigabatrin is likely to be more effective compared to ACTH. However, depending on each patient's circumstances, benefits, and risks profile, one should choose the treatment that fits for that patient or the family. When seizures occur late in life, because seizures may relapse after initially responding to ACTH or vigabatrin, or seizures may start later in life, and they may not be spasms, in that case, there is really no standard therapy. One could use a variety of broad-spectrum anti-epileptic drugs. As you know, most seizures in tuberous sclerosis are likely to be partial seizures, even if they have generalized semiology. So you have a wide array of broad-spectrum AEDs, some old, some new, with different safety profiles. And again, each patient, one should weigh in the benefits and the risks. One should look at the combination treatment they may already have and choose the best option. There are a few things one should keep in mind, especially if you're using drugs in a patient who have got kidney disease, or you're using drug in patients who may have some liver compromise. One should make the preference so that you lower any risk of producing or worsening their pre-existing dysfunction of kidney or liver, although liver dysfunction is very uncommon or almost not heard of in patients with tuberous sclerosis. It's more commonly the kidney involvement in later stages of life.
Yeah, but particularly in people with polycystic kidney disease, we often are concerned about topiramate or zonisamide or drugs that may increase their risk of renal stones that could precipitate renal failure in a patient that has PKD. Because you mentioned the two TS genes, but actually the TSC2 gene is adjacent to the adult polycystic kidney disease gene.
Correct.
So about 10% of patients with TS may also have polycystic kidneys. Mm-hmm. What do you see the role of epilepsy surgery in these patients, and at what point in the care do you consider that?
I think epilepsy surgery is a very effective tool in patients with tuberous sclerosis. I think that any patient with tuberous sclerosis, like any other patient with partial epilepsy, who fails to respond to a reasonable trial of 2 or 3 anti-epileptic medications, one should consider whether that patient is a candidate for epilepsy surgery. And when you're talking about epilepsy surgery and tuberous sclerosis, we're talking about perhaps resection of tubers, which are the lesions that are considered to be epileptogenic. And of course, the challenge is a typical patient of tuberous sclerosis has multiple tubers. They could be bilateral. One has to determine of the 8, 10, or 15 tubers a patient has, which one is most likely to be the source of epilepsy. Sometimes it's easy, sometimes it's hard. Sometimes tubers are merging into each other, forming a complex, and one has to then decide, do you take off a piece of that complex or a whole complex is epileptogenic? And it gets a little dicey because one has to do this evaluation in a patient who might be young, who might be uncooperative, who might have some behavior difficulty, where you have very significant limitation in mapping of the brain to discern where their language or motor capabilities are, because not only you want to resect the tuber to free their seizures, you probably want to make sure that you do not produce any new neurological deficits. So you have to ensure that the tuber is safe to resect. I think with available tools and technology and a lot of experience that have gone over years, epilepsy surgery is a very effective option in patients with tuberous sclerosis and must be explored. And somewhere in the range of 30 to 40% children with tuberous sclerosis might be reasonable or good candidates for tuberous sclerosis surgery. Now, obviously, sometimes one is doing surgery in this condition for not a cure of seizures, but palliation, especially when the seizure burden is so massive, or they have falls or injuries from seizures. So sometimes we do some other types of non-resective surgeries, like corpus callosotomy, where your hope is that you limit the burden of seizures or you limit the morbidity and mortality from seizures, knowing fully that perhaps the patient will still have seizures. However, you eliminate or at least you reduce the risk of having any potential harm from fall or injury.
What do you see or when do you use a vagus nerve stimulator or the ketogenic diet in tuberous sclerosis? Or do you see that as being the same as other people with partial seizures?
I think both of those are good options. Ketogenic diet is certainly an option which is perhaps a little bit easier to do. It's non-invasive. It's not a drug. And it can be done at any age, including infants. And it certainly comes as an armamentarium. And in fact, in certain patients who are not good candidates or where the candidacy for surgery is not clear, one could use diet as number 3 or number 4 option. For vagus nerve stimulator, I would think that if a patient is a candidate for resective surgery, one should prefer that. Vagus nerve stimulator is certainly an option in patients who have severe refractory epilepsy and who are not candidates for resective epilepsy surgery.
One comment I'll make is that it's recently been shown in the laboratory that a ketogenic diet or glucose restriction inhibits mTOR, the mammalian target of rapamycin, which is upregulated in patients with tuberous sclerosis. So that may very well mean that the ketogenic diet could be particularly beneficial in patients with tuberous sclerosis, and some investigators have felt that it's particularly beneficial for seizures. But obviously, seizures are one of the main issues we face in this patient. How important do you feel prompt diagnosis and early intervention are as far as long-term cognitive and behavioral outcome?
That's a great question. And I think more we learn about epilepsy and tuberous sclerosis or any other disease, more we realize that early intervention and early aggressive treatment to control seizure is really a key. And I think that any time you have seizures which are massive or high in burden and begin early in life, which is less than 2 years of age, and are uncontrolled, the chances of having cognitive impairment are very high. So I think one should put every resource in a child with seizures to have control of seizures as much as possible, always titrating to the side effects and the profile of the patient. And I think this is actually becoming clear with time. In my experience alone, when I see patients that are being treated now in the last 5 or 7 years, with effective treatments, and if they do better, one can see how their cognition and behavior seem to evolve in a positive direction compared to some of the patients that I see adults who are now in their 30s and 40s who didn't have those options available back then. And, of course, I wasn't in practice then, back then, but now I see them coming in wheelchairs, and they have a very high degree of mental and physical handicap. So I don't know. I'm just saying this as an anecdotal experience, but I think that early aggressive treatment, availability of good medical and surgical interventions for epilepsy has really made quite a bit of difference in determining the ultimate cognitive outcome in these patients. I would like your opinion on this too, though. What is your experience if you see patients now or younger generation having these treatment tools for seizures compared to the one in the past?
I completely agree with you. I just like to emphasize that. I mean, I remember about 20 years ago going to a lecture, and they were talking about pediatric epilepsy, and I remember the rather well-known speaker that we're both familiar with at my institution said that a patient with TS, when they start having seizures, they've fallen off a cliff. They just haven't hit the ground yet.
Yes.
And, you know, basically suggesting that, you know, there was nothing you could do, so why bother to try? That is, I think, a view that too many people still have, and I think it's been absolutely shown not to be correct. I mean, we know that if you control infantile spasms early, if you get good control of them, you have a better developmental outcome. I think we know that from the patients that have intractable partial seizures that get, you know, early surgery and get, you know, aggressive treatment. So, no, I think there are a lot of patients that would benefit from aggressive treatment and do benefit from aggressive treatment. And so this has gone from a disease that people have thought wrongly was hopeless, and in fact there's a lot you can do. And so, no, we're very aggressive in our treatment. Do you have any final comments or other remarks you'd like to make about anti-epileptic treatment in TS?
I would say that the treatment of epilepsy in TSC really needs to be customized for every individual, every patient with TSC. And really, you know, one shouldn't choose medication for in a very casual way. But I think every medication, when you give to a patient, benefits and risks should be weighed. Epilepsy surgery should be looked earlier, and certainly all options should be on the table as the patient go, always keeping in mind that each patient with TSC is different host to the disease, which is epilepsy. And it's a chronic disease, and one has to customize treatment and monitor very closely and adjust treatments over lifespan as necessary.
I think you're absolutely right.
So, Dave, now that we have talked about tuberous sclerosis and management of epilepsy and tuberous sclerosis, I would like you to tell us a little bit about the new exciting treatment opportunities in patients with tuberous sclerosis, especially when it relates to the subependymal giant cell astrocytoma, we're going to call them CGAs, or other tumors. As you know, there have been recent clinical trials and activity in this arena, and I would like you, as being one of the prominent researchers in this field, to help us know this a little bit. So can you please describe the underlying abnormalities in the biochemical pathways in tuberous sclerosis complex as a way for us to understand the role of these mTOR agents in the treatment of tuberous sclerosis?
Well, I'll just start by saying that when I started working with this disease, so about 22 years ago, people did not know they knew it was genetic, autosomal dominant, as you mentioned. They didn't know what chromosomes the genes were on. They didn't realize there were, in fact, two tuberous sclerosis genes. They didn't have any idea what the genes did or what their protein products were. And there's just been, particularly in the last 10 to 12 years, just an explosion of understanding about this. And it was driven primarily by cancer biologists, because the mTOR pathway is mutated in many types of cancer. mTOR, as I said, stands for mammalian target of rapamycin, and it was given its name because there was a chemical that was found on Easter Island that was found to have an antibiotic properties. It would inhibit the growth of certain fungi, and it was given the name rapamycin because the native name for Easter Island, where Darwin did his work, is Rapa Nui. So that's how
How fascinating, huh?
Yeah, so that's how rapamycin got its name. And then nobody really had, they knew that it inhibited the growth of funguses, but they didn't really know what else it did except it bound to this other protein. So they call this other protein the target of rapamycin, or TOR, so in mammals, mammalian target of rapamycin. Well, we now know that in tuberous sclerosis, you have two TS genes, TSC1 and TSC2. These each form a protein that binds together to form a complex. And the tuberous sclerosis gene proteins, or the protein products, they're called hemartin from TSC1 and tuberin from TSC2. They form a complex that serves to inhibit mTOR. And mTOR is a protein kinase that you can basically envision as controlling the metabolism of cells, the whether they go into division or not, whether they divide, whether they synthesize proteins. It regulates cellular migration and autophagy. And this is why, so when you have a mutation in one of the tuberous sclerosis genes, you are deficient in one of these proteins that serves to basically slow mTOR down, to inhibit its activity. So that causes cells in your body to synthesize more proteins, to be larger than they normally would be, to divide more than they should. And this is what's responsible for the hamartomas of tuberous sclerosis, whether they're in the eye, the brain, the skin, the kidney, or so forth. And again, this pathway, as I said, is mutated in a number of other diseases that have nothing to do with tuberous sclerosis on the surface, so different types of cancers. The mTOR pathway is involved in diseases such as progeria and Huntington's and Parkinson's disease. I won't get into that today. But basically, it became clear that rapamycin and drugs like it, such as everolimus, inhibit mTOR. And so that led to the idea that using these drugs in tuberous sclerosis where mTOR is too active, where it's constitutively upregulated, that could potentially be a treatment for the hamartomas and for other manifestations of tuberous sclerosis. In fact, we did the first trial of the drug rapamycin, the mTOR inhibitor of that agent in tuberous sclerosis starting in 2002, and that was looking at the effect of the rapamycin on the kidney tumors or angiomyolipomas of tuberous sclerosis. That study was positive. It was an open-label trial. It was published in the New England Journal in 2007, and then that was really the first report of this. We also then in 2006 published our experience using rapamycin to treat the subependymal giant cell astrocytomas. We treated 5 patients with giant cell astrocytomas that had exhibited growth on repeated MRI scans, and in each of those 5 patients, their tumors regressed. So obviously that was fairly encouraging. And then that led us to do a further study looking now with the drug everolimus, which is an mTOR inhibitor that is different pharmacologically from rapamycin, but it's derived from it in giant cell astrocytomas. And this trial involved 28 patients and resulted in everolimus being approved for the treatment of SAGAs or giant cell astrocytomas and tuberous sclerosis, as you'd mentioned. That was followed by 2 placebo-controlled trials, what known as EXIST-1 and EXIST-2. EXIST-1 was a placebo-controlled trial looking at the effect of everolimus in subependymal giant cell astrocytomas. The trial was recently released, and that was shown to be positive, so it confirmed a very potent effect of everolimus in shrinking the giant cell astrocytomas. EXIST-2 has been completed and should be released shortly, so we look forward to the results from that.
Good.
So again, basically, knowing that in tuberous sclerosis your mTOR is too active, it seemed reasonable to try drugs that would slow it down to as a potential treatment.
Well, that's a great news, and I think once considered a disease or a diagnosis where you just see patients and have nothing much to offer, I think now it's become really a model genetic disease where we have some very targeted treatment opportunities. What I would like to know from you, Dave, is that if a physician asks or wants to use an agent like everolimus or rapamycin for a patient with SIGA, what is What is the data? What's the expectation in terms of efficacy of this drug?
Well, that's the striking thing. Every patient that we have treated, either as part of a clinical trial or as before the drugs were approved, we've used these medicines off label, and now that they're approved, we've used them on label. And basically, we have never seen a patient that did not respond, that did not have a reduction in astrocytoma volume. So that's part of the reason that the FDA approved it based on just a single site 28-patient trial, because there was basically 100% response rate, which is quite uncommon. We did not see a clear relationship between dose and response, which is to say that patients that had a higher blood level, so you do blood level monitoring of this medication, we did not necessarily see that a higher level meant a better response. The interesting thing is that we saw not only reduction of the giant cell astrocytomas, but the patients that receive these medications typically also have improvement in their facial tumors, the angiofibromas, in their kidney tumors. So again, this is you may be starting a patient on it for a giant cell astrocytoma, but again, this has the potential to help multiple aspects of the disease. Now, these medications do have side effects. Some people may be familiar with rapamycin and everolimus with regard to their use as an immunosuppressant. They're used to prevent the rejection of transplanted organs. They inhibit the proliferation of lymphocytes, and that is how they have effectiveness in terms of preventing transplant rejection. What that also means is, of course, that patients may be more, these medicines are immunosuppressant, and patients may have an increased risk for developing infections. And in our trials, we've seen a number of infections, but they tend to be mucocutaneous infections. By that, I mean otitis, sinusitis. We've had no pneumocystis or any kind of opportunistic infections. In the cancer trials, it's known that people that have, say, chronic hepatitis B infection, sometimes that can be reactivated or something. Again, those are patients with cancer, so it's not exactly the same thing. The drugs do have interaction with other agents that everolimus and rapamycin are inhibited by the P450 system, particularly CYP3A. So drugs such as phenytoin and carbamazepine induce its metabolism. There are other agents such as verapamil and erythromycin that inhibit these medicines' metabolism. But generally, we found the medication to be well-tolerated in our clinical trials. Since these treatments have been available, we have stopped. And again, as you mentioned, our standard practice had been to remove these tumors once we saw them begin to grow. But now we've basically stopped doing this type of surgery and haven't done a Sega resection since about 2004, because really the patients that that take the medication, and that whether they're in the study or not, they're very pleased not to have to undergo an invasive brain operation, and plus many times they see benefits in other aspects of their disease as well.
So my question to you is, how do you decide between recommending a patient for Sega removal by surgery versus using everolimus?
Well, we do, now that the drug's approved, when we have a patient that has a growing Sega lesion, is we discuss all their treatment options. You know, so we talk about the potential use of surgery and what that would involve. We also talk about the various medications, the mTOR inhibitors that are out there. Rapamycin is an mTOR inhibitor. It's not approved for treating these lesions, but again, we studies have been done with that, approved for that. So we try to present all the options to the family.
Sure.
We typically have them meet with the neurosurgeon. We would not offer everolimus or rapamycin treatment to a patient that we felt had critical hydrocephalus or was in imminent danger of herniating. I mean, I think that's a situation where you need to undertake operative intervention rather than medical treatment. We try to give the patients information on both options, and then they ultimately it's their decision.
Certainly, and again, you know, one has to look at the FDA indication for everolimus, which is in patients who are not candidates for surgery. But certainly, options should be discussed, and just like you said, the treatment has to be customized depending on the benefits and the risks in each patient. It was interesting for me to know that there is no clear dose blood level and response relationship. So my question is, how do you titrate treatment of everolimus? How do you know which dose or what dose is good for what patient?
So again, there's in the FDA labeling, they talk about achieving a blood level of 5 to 15. And that is, so the immunosuppressive range for using everolimus is for a blood level, a trough blood level of 5 to 15 nanograms per milliliter. I'll just point out that if you happen to get a peak level, sometimes it can be 10 times higher than the trough level. So we have patients that have trough levels of 5 and they have peak levels of 50. So be careful, you know, about the timing of, you know, when you get the level. When we started our trial, our initial goal was to have a blood level of 10 to 15. Because that's the upper end of the therapeutic range for immunosuppression, and we didn't know if it was going to work or not, so we thought we'd kind of aim on the higher side. Well, what we found was we were almost never able to get the levels where we wanted them. Most of the patients, we would get them in the 5 to 10 range, but yet we saw that they all responded. So we shoot for a level in the lower end of the lower end of the range, say 5 to 10 trough, and then, of course, we do follow-up imaging to see if we're seeing a regression in the tumor, which we have thus far in every case, either in a study or when it's used off-label or on-label now. And so that's really the primary thing, is to see that the lesion is shrinking rather than achieving a certain blood level. Now, I will mention that when patients have stopped the medication or have come off treatment because for various reasons, you do tend to see that the lesions regrow over time. So it looks like this needs to be a longer-term sort of therapy. It's not something where you treat for 3 months or 6 months and then they regress and stay regress. We've seen that in isolated cases, but the majority of patients, if you stop the medication, the lesions tend to, you know, grow back to their baseline volume. So I think that's an important thing to consider. When you look at treatment with this, is that you are probably looking at long-term therapy. I think that the good thing is that you don't necessarily have to push this to high levels. So this is not like phenytoin, for example, where the higher the level, the greater the anticonvulsant effect.
So, as I understand, at this point, it's still unclear what could be the duration of treatment with everolimus, but like you're saying, it probably is a long duration because when you stop the drug, the tumors tend to regrow. That's the general observation you have made, correct?
That's correct. So I think when you look at using this medication, you have to plan that this is going to be a long-term treatment. Now, you may be able to use a fairly small dose. I mean, we found the drug to be well-tolerated in terms of side effects. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I think you definitely have to plan this being a longer-term treatment.
Dave, how often do you image these patients looking for a response or no response? Or you said response is usually typically seen, so how often do you image them?
Well, if we would start everolimus for giant cell astrocytoma, I would typically repeat the scan in 2 to 3 months. Now, if the lesion was unusually large or there were atypical features, I might consider doing it sooner. We have seen patients respond within 2 weeks. We've seen a reduction in volume in as little as 1 to 2 weeks. Again, that was not part of our trials. That were patients that was using the medication clinically. Once you demonstrate a reduction in volume, and by the way, when hydrocephalus is present, we have, in the studies, we saw resolution of the hydrocephalus, we would typically repeat the scan every 6 to 12 months. And again, I think that's a decision you would make based on the individual patient, the size of their lesion, and so forth.
All right. And once you see some regression in the size of the tumor, do they look different on the MRI?
Typically, they take up contrast less well, so they are less contrast-enhancing. We do magnetic resonance spectroscopy routinely in our patients, and we find that the choline resonance tends to decrease. Choline is a marker of membrane turnover, so the higher the choline resonance, that's suggestive of cellular division. Mm-hmm. So that basic, and the myo-inositol resonance increases. So this reduction in choline resonance and increase in myo-inositol is typical of the MR spectroscopy of a hamartoma rather than a growing lesion or a low-grade astrocytoma.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Dave, Are there any ongoing or planned trials of mTOR inhibitors in SIGA or other TSC-related tumors that you would like to share with us that are wrapping up or exciting data might be coming up soon?
Well, the EXIST-1 placebo-controlled SEGA trial is completed, and the subjects that are now in an extension phase. So the FDA asked Novartis to obtain long-term follow-up data in these study patients. So they will have the option of remaining on study for a total of 5 years to look for any, late-onset side effects or basically for long-term follow-up. The EXIST-2 trial, which is placebo-controlled study of everolimus, for renal angiomyolipomas, for the kidney tumors, it's completed enrollment and is in extension phase as well. We completed a trial that we're still analyzing the data, looking at everolimus's effect on epilepsy and tuberous sclerosis. I will say that preliminarily that looks very promising. So those trials are ongoing but close to enrollment. In terms of trials that are currently enrolling patients, there's a trial that we're doing. It's placebo-controlled, looking at the ability of everolimus treatment to improve cognitive performance and attention, to basically improve the cognitive deficits in tuberous sclerosis. That's being done at our center in Cincinnati and also at Boston Children's. There's a study that is being led out of by Hope Northrup's group in Houston, looking at topical rapamycin for the facial lesions of tuberous sclerosis. Patients put a topical preparation of rapamycin, which is not commercially available, and they look for, regression of the skin lesions. And there's a trial of everolimus in the patients that have lung involvement with tuberous sclerosis, which is called LAM, or lymphangioleiomyomatosis. I'd not mentioned another trial that was done at our site, but it basically looked at rapamycin and its effects on the lung disease associated with tuberous sclerosis, which is often progressive and fatal. And basically it showed what was demonstrated in our earlier kidney trial is that women with tuberous sclerosis that have LAM improve when they're treated with rapamycin or their disease stabilizes. So, again, that's being looked at with everolimus. So those three trials are the ones that are currently open and enrolling patients.
Lastly, Dave, I would like to ask you any final comments about the direction of future research with respect to TSC.
Well, we talked about mTOR, but really this mTOR is involved in a pathway that regulates cell growth in several different ways. There are several mutations that can affect this pathway and cause different diseases. For example, the gene that causes neurofibromatosis is involved in this pathway. So there are other drugs that have effects on mTOR and other elements of the pathway that are being developed that we look forward to studying in terms of their having a potential effect in tuberous sclerosis. There's talk of using combination treatments, of using everolimus or rapamycin with other medications, that might improve their benefits. So I think there's quite a bit of future research to be done despite these initial promising results, which we're have been quite pleased to have been part of.
That's great. Thank you. Well, we will conclude this session now. I would like to thank Dr. Dave France for sharing his time and expertise with us and for his participation in this Medscape education activity with me. To proceed to the online CME test, please click on the link Earn CME Credit on this page. Thank you again for listening to this activity.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Managing Neurologic Manifestations of Tuberous Sclerosis Complex. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.